Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're continuing our look at education this hour. We are focusing on the circumstances facing students in urban schools, the kids who, despite all the options discussed by policymakers, stay where they are. With us this hour, the U.S. Secretary of Education, Rod Paige. Now, we heard last hour from students at Dorchester High in Boston, students like Tawana Mack, who get no sense of community from school.
People look at kids as though that they're troublemakers and that they're not going to make it in life, that they're messing up our world. So everyone looks at us and we get mad. So things just happen. We end up killing families. We just don't trust our families. We don't trust the people around us. We get into gangs. So without after school programs and stuff like that, that can hold us in long enough and help us on our work so we can be better people, we're just going to be disasters. That's what I think.
Connection listeners, 3.5 million American students daily attend schools that have already been marked as failing. Are those students all destined to become, as Tawana says, disasters? What's the solution at the national level for those who don't opt out, head to charter schools, private institutions, vouchers? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Now back with us this hour is Sandy Simpson. She is Tawana Mack's teacher at Dorchester, starting her seventh year at the school, working with some of the top students there. And as I mentioned earlier, we're pleased to welcome Rod Paige to the program. After a distinguished 7 years as superintendent of the Houston Independent School Board, Mr. Paige was appointed education secretary by President Bush, and he joins us from a studio in Washington. Welcome to the program, Secretary.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if you were able to hear as you were settling into your chair a question that Pedro Noguera had for you at the tail end of our first hour, but in a nutshell, he was asking whether or not when you're a superintendent at a school board as large as Houston and banging your fist on the table and saying these things have to change to allow us to run our schools better, what's the shift like when you get to the job that's supposed to fix things?
Well, it's quite a different point of view. The superintendency has the opportunity for more hands-on operations, and you get immediate feedback. In the position I'm in now, it's more distant. I don't see students as often, and you don't get the feedback from your decisions quite as rapidly. So it's quite a different situation.
Now, in Houston, you had a high dropout rate. You had low test scores. And one of the things that you said, it kind of reflects on what you're saying from your position there in Washington, was you needed to decentralize, get power down to the people who can actually do something with it. Is that still a mantra that works for you in your current position?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the pillars that underpin the No Child Left Behind Act, the third pillar, in fact, is local control and flexibility, trying to reduce some of the bureaucracy at the federal level and provide more flexibility for those at the scene who actually see the students and walk up and down the halls of the schools. These are the people who are going to make the big decisions about whether or not schools work. And so we want to give them the opportunities to make those decisions.
There was one other point that I wanted to hear your response to that came up a couple of times in our earlier conversations about education, and that was that there's a mistake that's made, a fundamental policy mistake that doesn't sit with your administration or the one before or the one before that, but just in the whole theory of handling education, and that is that dealing with it separately from the social policy that governs the neighborhood and the parents and the city is one of the biggest flaws, because you can't fix schools unless you can fix the communities.
Absolutely. In fact, Hal Hodgkinson, the great demographer here in D.C., has a publication that's about, I guess, 10 years old now, and the title of the publication says it all, and it is One Client. The same students that's sitting in the classrooms in the morning are the same students that take use of the health services that the city provides, the same one that interfaced with the police, the same ones that use the public library. It's the same student, but yet we serve them in these in this disjointed way. Each of us pretend that we have total jurisdiction over it, and we're not collaborating nearly enough. It's one child, and we must get together to do a better job to serve them well.
But the knock against your administration, though, is that whatever money you may have been able to secure for education, and there was a significant amount of federal money put in with the Leave No Child Behind Act, that the same amount of money and attention is not being put in at the healthcare level, at the municipal level, where that support's required.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of complaints about that. And all of us know that resources are necessary in order to have good performance. But it's not necessarily just the availability of the resources. It has to do with the effective use of resources, how these resources are used. And I think it's a legitimate concern for us to be interested in seeing if we can improve the impact of the resources that we have available to us.
Sandy, you're in the classroom every day talking to the kids. Does the conversation about the responsibility of the politicians, people like Rod Paige, ever enter into that conversation? Is it something the kids are even paying attention to?
Daily, teenagers are very interested in the issues of class and race, and it's plainly obvious to them that there might be one planet, but there are many different worlds. They just need to look 10 miles to the west and to different schools within Boston to see resources working in a different way. I can assign a library project to my children, but they have to spend 45 minutes on public transportation to get to an open library. So while we might say resources will help the school system, it's resources that are needed in the community in order to make this whole package work for these clients or students.
Secretary Paige, you dealt with specific problems like this as superintendent in Houston. Give us an example of the type of solution that you would present to the type of circumstance that Sandy's discussing.
Well, first of all, we want to make sure that we take into consideration the fact that there's a big difference between the responsibilities and obligations of the local communities and that of the federal government. And so we can see those in two separate categories. And when I served as the superintendent of schools in Houston, my job was to interface with the local community leadership towards the goal of making things better for the community, including students more specifically.
Be specific. Give us an example of something practical that you were able to do that you look back on now or you refer to as a success.
Well, I think that my relationship with the mayor of the city was a big-time success. Mayor Bob Lanier, to begin with, and later on Mayor Brown, we were able to use our facilities together. One specific example would be that during the summer periods, the city needed places for their recreation program, and I made the facilities in our schools available, and specifically the swimming pools. We had swimming pools that the city could use, and they had a wonderful swimming program because we did this together. And it was an example of the community providing these resources, and we forgot about the boundaries between the city and the school district and just thought about the interests of the children.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, and David's calling us from Wellesley, Massachusetts. David, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to ask Secretary Paige about a big global question. It seems to me that the administration in Washington is saying that no child will be left behind, and that they've made that their goal, and that you are also saying that the way to accomplish this is by leaving all control to local organizations without any intervention by the federal government.
What kind of intervention would you propose then, David? What, be specific for the secretary.
Well,
you're talking about money, I guess? Is that, that's what I'm asking.
I think that I really didn't call you with a policy proposal. I just want the secretary to address the seeming contradiction between relinquishing control and at the same time pronouncing a national objective.
Well, we don't think we're relinquishing control. First of all, I'd be careful how I use that word, control. We are looking for results. And we don't believe that we can dictate directions to people across the United States because of the wide variability. We also believe in a simple principle. If we're going to hold the cook responsible for how the pie comes out, then we can't dictate the recipe to the pie, to the cook. Otherwise, we have the responsibility, and the cook can simply say, I did it the way you said do it. You are responsible for the results. So we have a framework of requirements, but we leave the specific compliance issues to those who are there, who are in a better position to make some decision because they see the children. They know what the circumstances are there. It's almost like being an absentee owner with respect to property. So it doesn't seem to be, for us, something that's contradictory to having responsibility. I'm going to use that word instead of control.
Secretary, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago the No Child Left Behind Act and one of the pillars there. Can you just give us the 30-second synopsis of those pillars so everybody knows exactly what it is that you're referring to when you refer to the act?
The No Child Left Behind Act is based upon four pillars that the president has to underpin his initiative for school reform. Four big principles. The first big principle is accountability for results. Those who have the responsibility should shoulder the responsibility, and we should not make excuses, but we should accept the responsibility for student performance. The second one is flexibility and local control. Those closest to the problem have the best insight to it. We should provide resources and a framework for change, but we should let them participate in the decision-making. The third one is expanded opportunity for parents. Parents should be a big part of the school reform initiative. In order to do that, we have to give them opportunities for choice. And the fourth one is research-based teaching strategies. We think that there's been an awful lot of work over the last two centuries, last two decades in teaching reading, yet we've made very little progress. Probably one of the reasons for that is that we've not been relying on scientifically based teaching strategies in order to make sure that our efforts will pay dividends. These are the four pillars that underpin the No Child Left Behind Act.
Sandy, if you stood in front of your grade 11 social studies class at Dorchester and tried to explain those, could you work with something like that?
There are interesting principles. It's difficult for me to feel completely accountable for the performance of my children, considering the baggage that they bring to the classroom and the stress that they and their families live under constantly. Flexibility of local control makes a certain amount of sense. Expanded opportunity for choice. Are we giving parents the option to leave the system, or are we giving parents the option to abandon schools? Sometimes those options aren't open for all of our parents. My school has 1,000 kids, and it's the least selected school, so I don't understand where choice comes in there. And research-based teaching strategies. I work with colleagues that have been working for 30 years. We continue our partnership with UMass Boston. We continue looking at our own self-research, and still we're faced with the same hurdles and obstacles each day, and we're not seeing a lot of improvement.
Connection listeners, who does get left behind? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Join U.S. Secretary of Education Rod Page, Sandy Simpson, Dorchester High School teacher, and myself for our conversation about the future of urban schools. David from Wellesley, thanks a lot for your call. Other Connection listeners, join us on the conversation. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. It doesn't cost you anything to call in. And you can call in this hour and speak with U.S. Education Secretary Rod Page about the situation facing urban schools. It's something that he dealt with specifically in his role as superintendent of the Houston Independent School District and deals with today in his job from his office in Washington. Secretary, I'm wondering, though, whether or not you don't feel a little bit handcuffed by the fact that though you have this great broad bully pulpit and terrific credentials to occupy it, You're speaking on behalf of a government that controls like 7% of the education funding in the United States and doesn't really have the clout or the wherewithal to necessarily back up the bully pulpit with the cash or the support that it might need.
Well, 7% of the education expenditures is supplied by the federal government, and that's a significant amount.
It's $22 billion,
yes,
roughly.
Yes, right. We think it is an important amount, and it is an important role that the government plays. The primary role has to do with providing access and advantages to those who are like that, those who need that help, making sure that the playing field is leveled.
This is about half the money going to Title I projects,
yes,
which are dealing with kids who are the most in need, right?
That's right. In fact, on the title page of the No Child Left Behind Act, the title page says, an act to close the achievement gap. That's speaking directly to those who are less advantaged. But, Dick, if you'd give me a moment, I would like to comment on the discussion we had just a minute before the break.
This was Sandy talking about...
And Sandy, right.
Yeah, go ahead.
First of all, Sandy, I have deep respect for the work that you do and that of all teachers, because I know teaching is a very intricate and difficult challenge. Remember that I'm a teacher too, and I grew up in a family of teachers. But I want to put forward a different point of view about the first pillar of the president's plan. And I didn't just join this plan to become a part of the federal government. I deeply believe in this, and this is what I use to improve the school system in Houston, which is not that different from Boston. We have to start with the premise that we in the school building and in the school district assume, and we take it upon ourselves to be responsible for the teachers, for the student learning. We can't start from the premise that we can't assume this responsibility because they bring certain baggage, or they come from across the track, or they have these difficult problems. That's our challenge.
I'm not trying to deny my responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, by being there every single day and being here to talk about it, I think I'm enhancing or trying to...
And I have nothing but appreciation for you, and I don't mean that you are. But I do want to put forward the premise that the accepting the responsibility for the student learner is fundamental to improving schools. And this doesn't mean that we're so naive that we don't know that it's very difficult, especially because students have so many needs. And that's part of our challenge, and that's why you and I and others like us are good at what we do. And that is why we can succeed at this. But we start from the premise that responsibility is ours, and we can accomplish this, and there are plenty of places in the world where it is being accomplished.
While I'm willing to accept the responsibility for being prepared in my classroom to teach, it is difficult for me to accept the responsibility for my students who are not ready to learn or do not have the same type of support that all students, that many students in the country have. The issues that my students have to face every single day are very different than the issues that many students have to face. And that while I work and they work incredibly hard to meet the standards that the state is requiring of them to graduate, I have students that have taken the MCAS every single time, that have done the tutoring after school and before school, and they are still failing. They're in my class every single day. What am I supposed to tell them? They're trying to the best of their ability, as are we. Something is not working in this equation, and it is certainly not that I am not accepting the responsibility of my teaching career, and it's certainly not that many of my students aren't accepting the responsibility.
I hope that you don't feel that I'm being disrespectful, because I want to be very respectful. And because I know any person who chooses our profession is a person who deserves respect. But one of the fundamental changes that we want to bring is the power of being accountable. You and I agree completely. It is difficult. It is much more difficult than the public gives us credit for. Teachers get nowhere near the respect that they need and deserve because of these social barriers and the pathology in the community in a lot of places. But these kids who suffer from that have only us to save them. And because of our excellence and our training and our commitment, we can do this.
Do you think, Secretary Page, that because it falls under the file heading of education, that the accountability you're talking about often gets, you know, challenged or dismissed because the only people who fit into that category are superintendents and teachers? We're not talking about social workers and mayors and the other people who you said are supposed to be a part of the equation.
Absolutely. And they should also be accountable. But the circumstances right now exist such that we can't do much about that right now. The thing that we can do a lot about is making sure that we use research-based principles, and making sure that our teaching strategies are based on science. We can make sure that we disaggregate the data and use data decisions, disaggregate it all the way down to the individual student, so that we can know what the specific deficits are for each child, so that we can be precise in our teaching. This is a very tough thing to do. The nation has given us a really tough challenge, and only heroes like teachers and like Sandy and others can get this accomplished. Right. But we began with the attitude that we are going to shoulder this responsibility, and we're going to do this.
Our number is 1-800-423-TALK to Louisville, Kentucky. Tom's on the line. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Secretary Page. It's a wonderful opportunity to be able to address you. I love your statement, "No child left behind." And I remember in Houston, you were a fantastic statistician. You knew everything there. And I also enjoy the accountability, and that's what I'd like to talk to you about. You guys have been in there almost 2 years now. Tell me, accountability-wise, how much have this gap have you all closed with these children?
Well, I think that's progress being made, but I think it's pretty tough to measure it now. I'm sure you're going to ask me that question. I want you to ask me that question in about another year and a half or 2 years so that we can have the data back and give you the specifics on it. Right now, schools are just beginning to implement the changes that we built into legislation. And by the way, these changes are not changes just that were built in by one side of the spectrum. The president is clearly the leader here, but this is a very bipartisan program. And it was supported by the entire Congress. And we just got it going now, and we do want to be measured because we have to be accountable. But the data is not in yet.
Tom.
Sir, do you think that a nickel, 7 cents on a dollar of help to the schools is going to be any good from the federal government?
Well, I think it is not the major portion of the resources, but it is an important part. In fact, in Houston, if I can remember correctly, our allocation from Title I was about $40 million. So that was a significant amount of money, and we could do an awful lot of good with that. Not only do we want to do good with the money, and the money is not the only measure. The principles and the programs and the ideas and the research would also be important to accomplishing our goal.
Well, I hope you accomplish it.
Well, thank you so much, and I hope you will share this with us and you get involved in your school system and help us.
Well, thank you. I will.
Tom,
thanks
for your call, 1-800-423-8255. To Raleigh, North Carolina, Peter's on the line. Hello, Peter.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead, Peter.
Well, I guess what I'd told the lady as we came into the queue here is I'm originally Oakland, California, so I understand the urban school system quite well and a former PTA president. So when he just spoke of involvement in the school, certainly I made my investment. But what I saw firsthand was the government tends to look at this as a mega situation, large. And yet, you know, as your other guest certainly spoke to, it happens in the classroom. And it's really the community is where things get pulled together, not from, you know, mass funding, not from large programs. And somehow, as she clearly pointed out, in the classroom environment, got to pull from the school back out to the community and back and forth. It can't be handled with just money. And federal programs have so many restrictions and so much accountability that at some point, as we did, we raised over $60,000 in our community in a 300 enrollment school and an elementary school because we just got so frustrated with the government programs. We'd rather raise our own money.
And it is true, some of the best support that we've gotten at Dorchester High have been from partnerships in the community. We have a professional development partnership with UMass. They've been with Dorchester High for over 20 years. There's organizations like Facing History and Ourselves that are there every single day in the classroom providing teachers with support. There's mentors, there's coach programs. Those are the organizations that have stayed with us in the long haul that are making the difference in our kids' lives.
Could I ask you, Sandy, in evaluating the value of those partnerships and the way that the students prepare for either the statewide testing you were talking about, the MCAS, or the nationwide testing that's a part of the administration agenda, do the two go together? Because it seems to me the closer you get to the community, the further you get out of that kind of everybody's got to meet a certain national standard test, but
I think it's just the opposite. One of the things with our partnership with UMass is UMass has come in and they're in our classrooms and they realize, I think, than even the mayor or the governor or the president, the challenges that we face in our classroom, and they help us develop curriculum and develop activities that help our students become critical learners. And I think that's what we're testing, or that's what we should be testing. We want our students to be able to participate in democracy and make a difference. And we need them to develop those kind of skills, and they need to be alive for our students. Learning can't be dry. We are fighting against the influence of media and technology that take up so much of our kids' time. And so through the partnership with these organizations, we're trying to make history and learning come alive for our students so they're willing and eager to participate in our democracy.
May I comment here?
Indeed.
I want to be careful to communicate that this program, the No Child Left Behind School Improvement Act, does not require national standards. As a matter of fact, we oppose national standards. What it requires is for each state to set its own standards. And we, the gentleman who just spoke earlier, we agree completely.
Mm-hmm.
Our goal is to provide the flexibility so wonderful people down at this local scene who know their environment best can make the decision, people like Sandy.
But aren't the national standards implicit when you have states comparing one against the other? I was reading a piece in the newspaper recently about how Arkansas was having particular difficulties, but none of the schools by those standards rated as failing schools. But because the state of Michigan has set high standards, 1,500 of those schools rate as failing. Now, you know, as people in this country, we look at the two, and it doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, that's not quite right. Each state has its own standards. And what Arkansas said was that the data, we require 2 years of data in order to make a decision about a school's progress. Arkansas said we only had 1 year of data. So consequently, we don't have any schools that fall into that category because we don't have the second year of data. Arkansas is now looking at that again. But it is completely an Arkansas issue. An example of our flexibility would be the teacher quality allotment and program. For example, we have $2.8 billion for states to improve teacher quality. We don't tell them how to do it. We just provide the resources And we depend upon the innovation of people like Sandy and others to decide what is the best way, how do you best use these dollars to make teachers better in Boston and in Detroit and other places like that. So not the national standards. We oppose that.
We might, you might, it might be fair to say that you oppose the national standards, but I'm so concerned about the endorsement of the state standards, because when we look at state standards and we look at the kids who are failing the MCAS and won't be given a diploma this year, those are the low-income kids. And if we're going to look at data, that tells us something about the quality of the programs in the community and the schools that are offered to low-income children. One of the things that we've done with UMass is develop a teacher training program where teachers who are committed to urban education can apply to our program and spend a year in the school, because most graduate programs don't prepare teachers to face the obstacles that occur yes. in the mm-hmm. city classrooms. And I think that's just symptomatic of the way our social policy works as well.
But that's what we want to help, Sandy. That's why we have the $2.8 billion for teacher quality that I just spoke of. That funding will help support the innovation that you've put there, and you and your colleagues there, the program that you have with UMass. This is an example of how you can use those dollars to improve the quality of teachers and instructions. It's up to you. That's an example of the flexibility that we're speaking of.
I'm talking about improving or allowing teachers who are coming into urban education to be prepared. I think that, and you've mentioned this before, that teachers mm-hmm. don't get enough respect, but I think there's a movement in the country to disregard veteran teachers as being good. And I think that's horrible. The more we lose our veteran teachers and push them out of the classroom, the more we lose the experienced artists of teaching, because teaching and learning is an art. And while we can base some of it on scientific data, we must realize that there is an art that needs to be learned.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And you're hearing a conversation between two people who know very well the education system in this country. We'd like to have you join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com. From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program today, Sandy Simpson. She's a high school teacher at Dorchester High in Boston. Rod Page is Secretary of Education for the United States. We're talking about urban schools. We've talked a lot this hour about No Child Left Behind. It is the education legislation signed into law by President Bush in January of this year. And it's legislation that was designed to give 3.5 million children in failing public schools in the United States the right to choose a better school. And yet when this September came around, there weren't a lot of spaces for them to move to, and there weren't a lot of parents asking to change. And Secretary, I want to ask you to weigh in on a philosophical aspect of this question for me, if you will, because that legislation gave the kids a chance to get out of the schools. Vouchers gives them a chance to get out of the schools. And I wonder if the message isn't these schools have failed, not are failing, but have failed, and these are all the different ways that we're going to try and help you get out of them. And then the sort of logical follow-up to that is, what about the kids who don't leave?
Well, first of all, you don't hear anywhere in our language failing schools. The language we use is need of improvement. A school may be successful for one child, but not for another. But the one thing that we want to be real clear about communicating is, and I'm going to try to paraphrase a statement that I heard the president use, and that is that the public education system could well be one of our nation's most important institutions. And our efforts are aimed at strengthening the public school system. When I was a superintendent in Houston, I woke up every day with the obsession to make the point to the public that the Houston Independent School District and the fourth largest city in America and the seventh largest school district in the United States could indeed be an effective system for delivering education to children. But in order to do that, we have to meet the competitive world. And we cannot protect ourselves from the challenges that come from the private schools. Or the homeschooling is one of the biggest systems, the fastest growing system in Texas now and in many other places, the charter school movement, others. My view is that when we operate at our best, we can be the best. But we have to meet the challenges. And I think that's good and healthy. It is the same type of response that you see to any institution when they find challenges from the outside. They strengthen themselves and get better. And that's what's happening now with the public school system. Our goal is to make the public school system better.
And Sandy Simpson, the...
And by the way, I should add that there are just worlds of good public schools, great public schools. There are many great public schools, in which case we want to make the good ones better.
Sandy, the conversation, again, in the classroom, you made the point a couple of times that it's the least chosen school in Boston, which means that the kids who are at Dorchester know that they're in the school which is the least chosen. It's not exactly the greatest sort of basis for school pride, but there is a little still just the same. And in the idea of whether or not you're going from grade 10 to grade 11 at Dorchester or looking for a way out, is looking for a way out an option for many of your students, any of your students?
I think it's an option for some of our students. Each year we'll lose one or two to the variety of options that are in the city. But more often we lose our kids because parents have to move for work or they're being shuffled from one guardian to another. One thing that you hear in our kids' voices, and I think it's one thing that's lost a lot from this debate, is that we don't listen to our kids enough. While kids understand when they're coming to Dorchester, many of them are scared. The reputation that we have is horrible. In reality, we don't find many weapons. There aren't more fights at Dorchester than there are anywhere else. The problems that we face are the problems that the kids face in the community, and they bring those, the stress of living. My kids are proud of the work they do. They are extremely proud of the things we do well at Dorchester. And there are so many successes at Dorchester. So once you get through ninth grade, get over the fear of being where you are, there are not many children or families that choose to leave. There is a pride in going to your neighborhood school. And even though our neighborhood is racked with poverty, people are proud. They're Dorchester Pride Day. We wear our colors proudly. We go to our games and kids show up every day. I think that many of the parents who their children end up going to Dorchester High haven't been given the same opportunity of educating, of being educated about the system in Boston. And so in many cases, they're there out of default. And it's the children that convince their parents throughout the years that it's okay they're there. There's the other aspect of the fear that our kids face, the fear of getting to school. Kids, there's a stigma about asking for help. So our kids, while they are very frightened about the things that are happening in their community, it's not happening in the school. It's happening outside the school. Kids, I think, feel safe in my classroom. So there are a lot of emotions that go with choice and selection, but many people choose to go to their neighborhood schools, and we have the responsibility to provide neighborhood schools for those districts.
So, Secretary, even if you live in Dorchester, even if you live in one of the low-income neighborhoods in Houston or Oakland or other places that we've talked on the program, that there's that part that pushes against the option out, and that comes from the parents or the kids who say, staying here, so well, fix it.
And we think that's great. Remember, what we want to do is offer parents options, not mandates. If they choose to stay there and work hard to make that environment much better, that's great. We applaud that. The problem we have is when they are chained to a situation that is failing them. We want them to have options, and we think that makes the situation stronger. In fact, in Houston, our strategic intent, which almost any employee in the system could verbalize and explain to anyone, was our intent is to earn so much respect from the citizens of Houston that we become the K-12 system of choice. We're going to give them a choice. And we're going to be that choice because we're going to earn that choice. So if they choose to stay, we're going to compete for them to stay.
Secretary, we have a number of people who want to speak to you on the phone. So we're going to go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Deborah's been waiting on the line. Deborah.
Hi, Mr. Secretary. I'm so glad to talk to you.
How are you, Deborah?
Fine. I live in North Carolina, as you just said, and I moved here from other school systems in the country, and I found that, well, we had standardized testing in certain grade levels. There was the CAT test, the California CAT test. And we were so bad, I think that's why the administration or whoever it was decided to have our own test, our own standardized test. So we no longer know how we compare to the rest of the country and how our teachers are doing. So I don't know that we would even know what the link is. I don't know of anyone here would even know how badly their schools are performing. I know because I had a child who was reading the Tolkien Sahara, but when he was three, but had severe learning disabilities, and I had to take the school system on by myself, and I'm the only parent who won an appropriate education for their child in that area. Everyone else, I was told, left the state. So
what are you saying, Deborah, that you would like national testing, national standards, state standards?
I think they need to take the bull by the horn, as he said. I think they need to completely usurp what North Carolina did and make us have the federal standards, because in the 70s, the first learning disabilities teachers were faced with communities that thought the kids had disabilities because the parent had sinned. That's the mindset. I mean, it's much better now, but that's where we're coming from.
And Secretary Page.
Well, our forefathers, the founders, the people who wrote the Constitution, in their wisdom, made this a state issue. And there are many people in the Congress now who are very serious about that. And so they oppose national standards, but support strongly state standards. Now, one way a school district or a jurisdiction could deal with that is they could voluntarily adopt tests that compare their students with national standards. They could do that, but there's no way we could demand it.
Sandy, the testing that you talked about earlier, the testing the students as critical learners, can this fit in the type of testing that Deborah's talking about, where the parents use the test to judge the quality of not only the education that the kids are getting, but the schools, the teachers?
I'm really not sure. I think in the past what we've done for accountability is look at where our students go after they graduate. And I think those are numbers that are left out of the equation. While many of my students who might not be passing the MCAS would, if it were not an MCAS year, would continue on to a two-year school and then a four-year school. They would be actively employed and they would be active members of their community. This standard of participation in democracy at its variety of levels seems to be dismissed now. We're looking at a type of testing for which all our children do not succeed for a variety of reasons. So while I believe in accountability, I also believe that the tests must be fair and they must have a variety of measures, not solely how many you got right on this particular standardized test. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, yeah, it does. And I thank Deborah for her call and turn back to Secretary Page with a question that came from Tom in Louisville earlier in the program when you said, you know, give us another year and a half. Ask me the question then. And in your own little day planner, what do you got marked down for 18 months from now? What will your measure of success be?
Well, I think there's only one measure of success for what we do, and that is the extent to which students learn and achieve. And I think the way you determine the achievement of students is through testing. So at some point, we're going to need to see that our students are performing better on state tests, on international comparisons, the gap being closed between how our kids perform and our international neighbors, how they perform. So I don't think that we can measure this by the amount of money we spend or the amount of inputs we do or put into the system. There's only one measure for me, the students' learning. And how do you know if the students are learning? You have to test them to see if they are learning.
And when you look at the results of those tests, are you going to be able to sit at the cabinet table with the president and say, you know, we're not at the marks we should be. We need to be talking about the level of poverty. We need to be talking about welfare. We need to be talking about the kind of social support that those kids require to be better students.
But I'm not going to use any of that for excuses. That's something the HHS can deal with. I'm going to talk about how much progress they made in reading. I'm going to talk about the number and percentage of our students who are reading by the end of third grade on grade level. I'm going to talk about how many fourth graders measure appropriately and achieve proficiency on the NAEP. Those are the measures I'm going to use.
Secretary, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Sandy Simpson, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
U.S. Education Secretary Rod Page, Sandy Simpson, social studies teacher at Dorchester High School. Connection listeners, we encourage you to continue this conversation. You know where to find us. We're at the website, theconnection.org, and we have forums there that allow you to exchange your views with other people. We had help with our program today from Kim Bichari, Darren Manoogi, and Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Graham Smith is our senior producer. My name is Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. This is